art is not just images. You can have images that are not art. Just making images does not mean you're making art. There are even artists who make images, which I don't think are art. So the idea that some artificial means could do the same thing.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. My name is Garrick Jones. I'm one of the co-authors of the book The Curious Advantage, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Sir Michael Craig-Martin. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Garrick.
And welcome to The Curious Advantage podcast, Michael.
I'm happy to be joining you.
I've been really looking forward to our conversation. I'm going to get straight into it. Your career as an artist has spanned several decades and the focus on your famous paintings and sculptures and printmaking. And you've got this enormous career retrospective coming up at the Royal Academy in London in September 2024. Can you tell us a little bit about how your journey has led you to where you are today?
Well, that's a very long story, Garrick. So I went to art school in America at Yale, and I came to England immediately afterwards. And to be honest, I've never done anything since then, except I've done other things like teaching, but I've always worked as an artist. That's all I've ever done, really, in my whole life. I feel like I never had a plan for anything that I did. I followed the work. And I feel like I am the agent of the work. I just do what it tells me to do.
It's incredible. Just to turn to you, you were a teacher at Goldsmiths for many years, but you taught many of the UK's most celebrated contemporary artists, including Damien Hirst and the YBAs, or the Young British Artists, as they became known. What was it about the YBAs that made such a significant impact on the UK back then, both culturally and economically, I guess?
A lot of what has to do with success and is to do with luck. There's a degree of timing. If you get your timing right, it can mean everything. And something happened towards the end of the 80s when I was teaching at Goldsmiths. I've been teaching since the 60s, but suddenly I was aware that I was teaching. I had a lot of very, very talented students. And they were connected in some way. They were very aware of each other. They were jealous of each other. They were interested in each other. And there was a chemistry between them, which I had not experienced before. And there was a moment when they were very young. They were very, very ambitious. And they weren't prepared to wait for somebody to offer them something. They kind of took the idea of being an artist into their own hands at the age of 21, 22, 23. And it just happened. That was a moment when the art world was prepared to accept that. And so out of all of those elements came this kind of flowering of something in the 90s. And I, to be honest, I look at, because I've known British art education for so long, it took several generations to produce what happened across all the arts in the 90s. That didn't happen. Things that happened that looked like they happened overnight never happened overnight. It's just you haven't realized what was going on in the background. And it took two or three generations to get there, and flowers in a very big way in the 90s.
When they say after 20 years of hard work, you might be an overnight success.
That couldn't be more. I'm the perfect example. I'm 83.
You've been outspoken on the need for art education and its impact on society and the economy. Can you talk a little bit more about why you believe it's so important?
I think that the arts are really quite different from other things. And it's one of the reasons why people with very little imagination are very suspicious of them. It's because, unlike many other aspects of life, they are fundamentally based in the pleasure of doing something. You can't do the arts if they don't give you pleasure. There's no reason for doing them. The reason you paint is because it gives you pleasure. The reason you play a musical instrument is because you, it's not just a career move. It's not just a way of making money. It's not just a way of doing something else. You can't sustain self-generating engagement without pleasure. And in a world where so much of education is based on a sense that being miserable with it and having to be forced to do things is the proper way to learn, it upsets a lot of people to think that you can do something worthwhile based in the pleasure of doing it. And it's so important for people to learn, because the fact is, if you can understand that, the value of that, you can bring that to every activity you do, no matter whether it's art or not.
It's interesting you talk about pleasure being this driver and its impact on us individually. What about things we're afraid of and the relationship between that exploration and pleasure and fear, for example? Opening a door, going through it, we might be afraid. How does that relate to giving us pleasure and motivating us?
Well, I think, basically, people are fundamentally conservative. We are all cautious about the unknown. And I often have people say to me, I'm really interested in seeing something new. But the reality is that when they are presented with something new, they reject it because it's either unnerving in some way, or the very fact that it's new, what it means by new is you don't already have in place the parameters by which to understand or appreciate something. Everything I've ever done that was new, my work, has been cautiously received the first time and much more enthusiastically received the second time.
Why do you think artists are so important to society? And why do you think society needs to have artists?
I think the role of the artist is as an observer. To me, the most interesting art comes from observation. Observation can take many forms, but it's to do with being able to reflect back on what it is that the world gives us. And everybody has a different take on this. Everything that's special about every individual person is the thing that is basically where they are an artist, because it's your individuality and your individual perception of things that makes you who you are. And one of the problems in life, one of the problems of many people who wish to be artists, is that what comes naturally to you, one often undervalues because it seems easy, because it seems natural. And you assume that it's natural to you, then it must be natural to everybody. When in fact, it's nearly always that makes you different from everybody else, and everybody else is quite surprised that you could do this and they can't.
So we're talking to Sir Michael Craig-Martin. Michael was born in Dublin in 1941. He grew up in the United States, where he studied fine art at Yale, and he's been based in Britain since 1966, mostly as a teacher at Goldsmiths. And his first solo exhibition was at the Rhone Gallery in 1969. He has black and white wall drawings, vibrant paintings, and installations. Notable commissions include the European Investment Bank in Luxembourg, University of Oxford, Leban, Down Centre in London, and HEI Gerling headquarters in Hanover. Over the past four decades, he's exhibited globally at venues such as the Centre Pompidou in Paris, MoMA in New York, various Kunstvereins in Germany. He represented Britain in the 23rd Sao Paulo Biennial and had retrospectives at the Whitechapel Art Gallery in 1989, the Irish Museum of Modern Art 2006, Serpentine Gallery 2015, and Seoul Korea in 2022. Recent exhibitions include Less is Still More at Creffield Museum House Esters, Sculpture at Chatsworth House, Now, a touring exhibition in China, and a retrospective at the Seoul Art Centre. A notable teacher at Goldsmiths College, London, Michael Craig-Martin was a Tate trustee from 1989 to 1999. He was awarded a CBE in 2000, elected a Royal Academician in 2006, and was knighted in 2016 for his services to art. Michael, back to this lifetime retrospective, you are putting all of this together for the Royal Academy. It's opening in September, which is not that far off from where we are today in August. And you're also, I'm aware, compiling several books to accompany the exhibition. This must have given you an amazing opportunity to review the entire arc of your career. What are some of the highlights or some of the things you've experienced through this process?
Well, it's an incredible privilege to be doing an exhibition of this scale at this time of my career, and to go back and go through virtually everything I've done and try to make a selection of things that trace the course of the work. It's a retrospective in a truly chronological sense. It does, one thing leads to another, so that somebody who maybe only knows my work of the last 10 or 20 years would be able to follow the path about how I got here from where I started. And it is a path, and it does lead quite logically, in retrospect, to where I am.
I mean, that's amazing, considering what you said earlier about how you've always followed the work and left the work. How, can you give us a sense of how that works for you? What does it mean to follow the work and to allow it to lead you on this journey?
Work comes from work. It doesn't come from inspiration or other considerations, really. When one's working, as one's working, things come to you through the work itself, and that tells you what to do next. That shows you what the opportunities are. And sometimes it's a very small thing, and it's a simple thing. And other times it is actually an insight, but it only comes because you happen to be there in the work at that moment, and then it opens a door. Every time I have thought that my work had reached an ending and that I thought, oh my God, you know, I'm finished, amazingly, just at that moment, another door opens up. And it's always a good idea when a door opens to go through it.
Can you give us an example? Can you think of some of those doors that may have opened up?
Well, there's one very recent one, which is quite extraordinary. When I was offered to do the retrospective at the Royal Academy, I was asked if I would do an immersive digital work, which is a very contemporary thing to do. I've never done one before. I said yes, because I always say yes. And it's turned into something just extraordinary. I'm still working on it. It won't be finished until the end of August, and the show opens in September. I think it could be one of the most important things I've ever done. And if it hadn't been that I was asked to do it, I wouldn't have done it. The work, it came from what was happening. I just followed what was there.
Your digital art, I'd like to talk about a little bit. Not everyone may be aware, but you have a remarkable body of digital work, particularly your digital portraits, which are among my personal favorites. Many notable figures have been captured in your portraits. And just to describe one, it's sort of a screen on which one of your famous colored images of the person in a frame. But the colors change continuously and infinitely. So each one is an algorithm, pretty much, that constantly shifts and creates an ever-changing display on the screen. I find them compelling. There's an amazing one by Laura Burlington, which I really like. And you began this series well before NFTs and digital became popular. And to my mind, these are some of the first really digitally generated artworks. I don't know what others think, but they've always grabbed me as being so ahead of the game. What got you to that point? What inspired those concepts?
Well, I had already done some earlier digital works involving groups of objects, very small monitors with a live computer where there were images of objects, like a group of objects, maybe 10 objects, which would either change color or fade and disappear and then reappear. The thing that was special about them was that they weren't recording. It wasn't a video. The computer was live, and the computer had a program which gave it the opportunity to decide what color how long the color would appear, what would be the next color, which essentially meant that what you were looking at was constantly changing, and you almost never saw the same thing again. Yet by the time you did, you would have forgotten. So I then was asked to do a portrait for the National Gallery, and I had never done a portrait or anything like that. But when I was told that it was Zaha Hadid, I thought, well, she's such a fascinating person. I immediately said yes. And I started to try to paint a portrait of her, and it was unsatisfactory. And then I suddenly thought, well, if I did the same thing of having the features of the face constantly but very, very slowly change color, and to do it live, it's like a living person. It's like having the moods. It takes on a psychological meaning when you have the face changing color. So it just seems so ideally suited to the question of a portrait, and that's where they came from.
I'm curious about the development of things like artificial intelligence, for example. Do you have a view on artificial intelligence? And I'll load it a little bit. You know, artificial intelligence is now generating imagery, and it's very obvious when things are artificially generated these days, but they're very complex ideas. I mean, do you have a view on artificial intelligence, whatever that is, and specifically the kind of this rapid generation of images?
I don't really have a proper view of artificial intelligence, partly because I don't fully understand it, and also I haven't had direct engagement personally with it. But there's one thing I would say: art is not just images. You can have images that are not art. Just making images does not mean you're making art. There are even artists who make images, which I don't think are art. So the idea that some artificial means could do the same thing. One of the things that I feel very aware of is the arts are essentially, as I'm speaking about pleasure, they're based in emotion. Their fundamental essence is not in a kind of academic intelligence. It's one of the reasons I think why very often academically and educated people find the arts quite difficult is because it doesn't conform to academic standards. Because it's not based intellectually, it's based emotionally. And who am I to know, but is it really possible for a machine to fake human emotion? When I look at somebody's work that I find that I'm moved by, I'm entering their sensibility, their world. They've offered it to me, and I'm responding to it. It strikes a chord with me, and I'm sharing something of their feeling through the work. Could I do that with a work made by a machine imitating a human emotion? I don't know.
I don't know how much you can tell us about what you're doing at the RA with this state-of-the-art immersive technology, but can you give us a little hint or some insight into what we can expect and what's coming?
Yes. When I was first asked, I really didn't have any idea about what to do, and I was trying to look back at things I'd already done to see if there was something that I could adapt to that situation. And then something struck me which would be to use hundreds and hundreds of images. I've been drawing images of objects in the same way since 1978, and I have hundreds of them. And so I decided to take a large number of them. It turned out to be around 300. And I then adapted them to the digital format. And I'm working with an engineer who I have, a technician who I've worked with over all these years. And I said, well, here are 300 images. What can I do? And then he showed me what the technology could do. And I have to say, it's blown my mind, and I'm hoping that it will have the same effect on others.
One of the things that strikes me is you have one of your titles was Less is Still More. And I remember Andy Warhol's quote where he was saying, always leave them wanting less. Why did you choose less is still more for your exhibition title.
Well, the exhibition was in House Esters, which is a very early house designed by Mies van der Rohe, who is famous for the idea of less is more. And less is more has a strange kind of fashionability. It comes in and out of fashion. And when I did the exhibition, I thought that the idea of less is more was slipping away, but I wanted to remind people it was still an operative idea, and it still worked.
Do you still believe that?
Yes. I'm not a minimalist, but I do think it's very important that one of the lessons from minimalism is that absolutely everything matters. Everything counts. There's nothing that one shouldn't pay attention to. You need to give your attention to every detail of everything. Everything deserves its place.
Less is certainly not more when it comes to your distinctive colors. And your works and your sculptures, like reliefs of light bulbs and spades and a shoe and the fountain pen at the University of Oxford, you always sort of use these everyday objects. What is it about these kind of everyday objects that you find so compelling?
To be honest, it's been in my work since from the very beginning, and I don't truly know why. I don't really have a clear sense of the reason for that, except going back to my childhood, from a very, very young age, I was very visual in my interests. Everything about the visual world fascinated me. And whether it was objects or artworks or places, virtually anything that was the focus of my attention was always on what was visual. The other thing was, again, from a very early age, I was fascinated by that which was modern and contemporary. And I grew up in the late 40s and the early 50s, when what we see now as the modern world was really being created. And I feel like I was there when the roots of how the world looks today were being laid. And I was fascinated by that.
It's amazing. It's a curiosity, really, that comes to mind, of course. And can we talk about artists and the practice of art and curiosity? As we have to a little bit, but what is your take on curiosity? How we can all cultivate it successfully?
Well, curiosity seems to me to be at the root of everything that I do. I consider that I can only do something if I'm curious about it, and my curiosity is based on the fact that it contains something I don't yet know, I don't quite understand yet. It's not interesting to do something where one knows everything about it. And, you know, I see it very clearly in looking at my retrospective. The work I've done in the 70s is different than the 80s, and the 80s are different than the 90s. In a purely practical sense, I could do again the work from those different decades. Physically, it's potentially possible. But psychologically, it's absolutely out of the question. I could not possibly do the work of that time. It came from what was curious to me at that moment. And when the curiosity goes out of it, the ability to actually do it disappears.
That's fascinating to me from a psychological perspective, because there's so many ways to approach curiosity. One is, you know, I want to know about something. You choose the topic, and then you find out how you can get there by meeting people or exploring or researching or learning something or putting on an exhibition or show. You're kind of working towards a target. Whereas the other way of doing it is from what you're talking about, you know, how you find it in the work and how the work instructs you. You just start doing something, and through that process of making, you become curious about something else. As you put it, another door opens. It's amazing to me that curiosity can be led by simply doing and simply being engaged with doing something rather than having a specific target to achieve something.
Yes, I feel that is interesting, because I don't feel like I've ever worked to a target. I haven't had an agenda. If you had told me when I made the first drawings of objects in 1978, that these long years later, I'd still be making drawings of objects in exactly the same way, I'd have thought you were nuts. I mean, it would never have occurred to me that it could give me a path that was so long. Astonishing.
And your sort of art career took off after you retired. Is that right? I mean, you were known as an artist before that, as you were teaching and so on, but it sort of went stratospheric after you retired.
Well, I mean, I taught, as many artists of my generation did, as a way of making a living that kept you close to art when I couldn't make any money from my work, and certainly not enough to live on. The ironic thing is that the year that I first was felt able to stop teaching, because I was making enough money from what I did that I could quit, because that had always been my intention, was in 1988, which was exactly the year that Damien Dupriez and my teaching became famous, was exactly the year I stopped. But life is full of these ironies. I really, you know, during the period when I was teaching, I did half the week teaching and the other half of the week was devoted to my work. You know, if there's a period in one's life as an artist when one makes sacrifices, for me, that was that time. I didn't take a vacation for 20 years because I needed that time for my work. And I could never be in the situation that I am in today if during the years that I was teaching, I stopped working. If I hadn't kept working during those years, I would, and that's what the retrospectives help us show, all the work that was done during all the years I was teaching. I greatly enjoyed it when I was doing it, but I was teaching at a period that was a kind of golden age of art education in Britain.
I hope it comes back. I mean, I think it's important, artists, as you say, not only to reflect, but also to challenge us, to make us think about things that we take for granted in new ways.
I also think there's something interesting about, you know, I think of the YBAs. One, it's a kind of terrible term, YBA, but young British artists. But the fact is, they were all very, very British. There's a kind of attitude in them that is not, it's not American and it's not European in the continental sense. It is something a bit different. And there is one of the ironies, again, about Britain is that in some ways it's the most skeptical country about anything new, about the arts, about, and yet it's a kind of cultural powerhouse. It's a creative powerhouse that produces an unlikely number of highly creative people in many different fields, at the same time as barely valuing it.
Yeah, so you talk about innovation and the realization, you talk about other spheres, you think about the film world and the incredible film education we have in this country. And then people have to go abroad in order to find work.
This is true of everything. If you don't have success abroad, you're never going to be a successful artist in Britain.
But and then you get the success abroad.
Nor will you ever make a living.
That's right. Does the success abroad mean you eventually become respected back home, possibly?
It's suddenly it starts to dawn on people back home. There's so much in Britain. I mean, it's very striking, very, very striking about how important. And I think that goes, some of that is to do with the nature of the British educational system as it has existed. It's been under terrible pressure and damage over the last 20 years and more. But in essence, it's a system that works creatively.
What do you mean by that? It works creatively.
The essence, in my experience, of British education is that it leaves a great deal of responsibility in the hands of the individual student. You have to take responsibility for yourself. You have to be self-motivated. There's lots of ways in which you are an independent operator within the educational system, and it gives you whatever you put into it in a very particular way, but it does allow you an unusual degree of individual freedom if you use it properly. And that makes it quite unique as an educational system.
That's right. I remember coming to university here being kind of shocked by how much responsibility was put on to my hands, and also responsibility for putting my own kind of curriculum together. Well, on reflection, it must breed a kind of creativity, as you say. You've got to get on with it so much. I have to ask you, what are you personally most curious about right now? I mean, beyond your RA exhibition and all of that, do you have time to be personally curious?
I'm curious about funny things like, how long am I going to live? You know, at my age, it becomes an issue. And I feel very, very fortunate to be able to stay, hopefully, engaged in the world around me. The thing about young people is they are effortlessly engaged in the world of the moment. That's one of the great positive things about being a teacher, is to be engaged with students, because if you want to understand the world, you're much more likely to understand it through them than they are through you.
Thank you so much for joining us, Michael. I wish you all the best for your exhibition in September. And thank you for talking with us today. We've covered a lot of territory, from curiosity and how to approach the work and allowing the work to drive the work and open doors. Don't be afraid to go through the doors and allow them to take you places, all the way through to your digital work and some of the groundbreaking stuff you're working with now. But thank you so much for talking with us today. Very much appreciate it.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Garrick, and thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast, where we've been talking with Michael Craig Martin. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understandings from neuroscience, anthropology, art, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity, and makes these useful for everyone. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel, saying why this was so and what you've learned. We also appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today, hashtag Curious Advantage.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.